Hey, it's Anita. It has been a while. So much has happened since we launched Embodied, and it is all good stuff. I can't say thank you enough to the thousands of you who've decided the conversations on the show are worth subscribing to. If you've told anybody, even just one person, about the podcast, know that your recommendation is invaluable, and I am so grateful. We are already working on what to bring your way for a second season coming soon, and I can't wait to share it with you. But no one likes waiting, so I have something for you in the meantime. We can hang out virtually together on Thursday, December 17th at 7 p.m. We're going to be doing a live podcast taping of Embodied about how the transgender community is responding to incoming President Joe Biden and his pledge to overturn the ban that keeps a majority of trans folks from serving in the military. If we've learned anything on this show over all of our episodes, it's that the personal is almost always political. So why don't you join me for a special night of conversation on December 17th? To sign up, just go to the events tab at WUNC.org, look for Uneven Battlefield, and RSVP. While I have you, I would love to share an amazing story. This one comes from our friends at the podcast The Double Shift. Host Catherine Goldstein and her crew explore working motherhood in fascinating ways and issue unique challenges to the status quo in every single episode. This one that you're going to hear is centered around a transgender man named Ted. After giving birth to 5 children, he's created a life outside the single family model by raising his kids in co-housing. And just a note that this episode was recorded before the pandemic, when living in close proximity to other people was a lot easier. I'll let Catherine take it from here.
Today's episode goes way outside the box of quote-unquote traditional modern American family life. We'll visit a co-housing community and get to know a person named Ted Rao. Ted now identifies as a transgender man and is a parent to 5 children. His story presents a fascinating and nuanced take on gender and motherhood.
Just being on the playground, you know, it used to be that presenting female, you had all, like, you could just walk up to any other mom and talk. And now that's not an option.
Ted arrived in the U.S. from Germany in 2010 after getting a PhD to do 2 years of postdoctoral work in linguistics. At the time, Ted was married to a man and was female presenting. He had given birth to 4 kids, and the youngest was 6 months old. And now we want to take you through some pretty classic challenges and dilemmas he faced as a mother thinking about family life and career. After many years of study and finishing his postdoc, Ted decided academia wasn't for him and wouldn't be compatible with family life. But he and his husband decided they wanted to stay in the U.S. His husband got a work visa, but Ted couldn't get one for quite a while. So Ted, who at the time identified as a mother, stayed at home with the kids. And so you are now at home with 4 kids at the time, and at some point there's a 5th child on the way, is that correct?
Right, because once you're already home, you can as well add another kid.
Just keep adding. So you have 4 kids at home, you have 1 on the way, and you start homeschooling them. And homeschooling and 4 kids and being pregnant, that sounds like a very 24/7 kid-centric life. Did you enjoy that? Was that a happy time in your family?
Well, it's funny that you asked those 2 questions. Did you enjoy that, and was it a happy time? I think back to it as, I think, the happiest family time that we had. So that's me and the kids. Just because we learned so much together, we explored so much together, and I loved that part of it. I personally was not very happy. So it's some happy, sad memories there. I loved the togetherness, the sort of tribal feeling of the 6 of us, and I was intellectually bored. And homeschooling or parenting in general, and, you know, of course, that has its value, nothing against it. Yet, if that's the only thing I'm doing, then there's a lot of repetitiveness, right? You get up and there's laundry again, and the kids are hungry again, and they still don't like broccoli. You know, like, it's just, there's just so little forward motion. And I still am reminded sometimes of that time, for example, during summer break or just a weekend. It sounds like I'm complaining about time with the kids, and that's not at all the case. What I'm complaining about is that during the times I spent with kids, nothing else gets done. And that's what I'm mourning. So I'm not complaining about the time I'm spending with kids, because that's typically great. Yet, I really also need to move things forward somewhere in my life. So the fact that it was exclusively time with children, that was the problem.
Right. That there wasn't outlets for other kinds of projects or creativity or intellectual stimulation.
Yes.
Tad and his family realized that if they were going to stay in the States with all their kids and no extended family around, they wanted more support. They found out about a co-housing community, an intergenerational 32-home complex in Massachusetts on 22 acres of woods and farmland. Each family has their own private home with, you know, bedrooms and a kitchen, living room. But there's a big common house where residents have meetings and dinners twice a week. There are gardens, a hen house, and playgrounds. The co-housing membership is self-governed, and each adult has to do 6.5 hours of work for the community per month, from planning meetings to doing dishes after the communal meal to yard work. Cars are parked on the outskirts, so it's pedestrian-friendly and safe for kids to roam. Tad and his family took a tour to see if it was for them back in 2012 and fell in love with it.
And I remember that my oldest daughter, she must have been 9 at the time. So we pull out of the community as we leave, and she says, "Okay, when are we going to move in?" And she was just voicing exactly what we all were thinking of, like, yeah, I think this is a done deal. We're staying here. This is awesome.
What do you remember? What are some specific things that stood out to you in the beginning about why this place was so special and felt right for your family?
You know, kids as young as 4 or 5 can just go roam. And, you know, then often what my younger kids in particular do is they walk around and they chat with this neighbor that's in their garden. Then they go there and then they help something real quick here. So there's just so much stimulation and so much... what's the word? I guess integration with other people's lives. You bump into each other more often. And that's how I want to live, and that's how I want my kids to live. I want to not have to make an effort to be somewhere. The way I was socialized in Germany was you just go out on the streets, right? And that's, I know how many people in this country also grew up that way. But here that in co-housing, that's actually still true. You just go outside and look who else is outside. You don't have to arrange a play date, you know, which seems such a grown-up-y concept, you know, to like arrange a date and then somebody drives you and then you're there and 1.5 hours you're being picked up. That just seems so cumbersome as a social life. And in co-housing, it all just flows together. You just go outside, there's other people, you chat, you help something. It has just a much more organic flow to it.
Do you feel like this community helps the experience of parenting be less isolated?
How many yeses can I say here? Yes, and that's an understatement. I can't count the times I was bailed out by a neighbor. It's, you know, let's say, what a good example. So my kids basically have what we call adopted grandparents here, especially two women in the community. That's where they go when they're upset with me. That's where they go every Tuesday because they want to. My kids know by heart when, you know, that particular neighbor comes out of work, because then they linger around her house and, you know, to be the first one to greet her. I remember I have one very sweet story. It was a Saturday morning. I was sick. I hadn't slept well. I was alone with the kids. Different people had to be driven different places at different times. And it was just incredible. It was daunting, just not feeling up for the task. And I was just saying that to the children, you know, just like, whoa, I really don't feel well. And right now I have no idea how to even survive this day. And daughter number 3... she must have been, let's see, maybe 10 at that place, said to me, "Okay, look around you. Where are you?" And I said, "In co-housing." And then she said, "Yeah, that means you're not alone. There's people here to help you." And I said, "Well, thank you for reminding me. It's so easy to forget. You're right." And, you know, and you can just send out an email to the whole list and there will be somebody that can help you. So many times when I was sick or I needed an extra ride and needed an extra that... you know, it's way beyond just the the stereotypical cup of sugar. It's way beyond that.
One of the reasons that we wanted to do this whole, we're doing a whole season about reimagining family and thinking about community in different ways. And one of the reasons I wanted to do that is because I feel like the ethos in America is basically like, if you have kids, you're on your own to figure it out. Like, it's up to you to just figure out every element of that and make it work for you. And there's not much sense of communal responsibility or communal help. And do you have a, is there a sense in the community that the community is responsible for the kids in a way that sort of goes beyond just, you're the parent, it's your job to do this?
Yeah, to the extent that we're all responsible for each other. So the idea of what I would call interdependence is just something that is obvious to people if they choose to live in a community like that. We are not on our own, and we don't want to be on our own, and there's no point in proving that you can do it on your own if it's much more fun and easier to do it with others. It's just not buying into that narrative of you have to prove yourself.
Ted's family is very happy with their community, and they're not the only ones sold on the benefits of co-housing. The model was created in Denmark back in the 1970s. Ted's is one of approximately 165 co-housing communities here in the U.S., and enthusiasm for the model is growing, with around 140 more in planning stages across the country. They are becoming especially popular with empty nesters and young families. And while Ted can't imagine living anywhere else, he says he can see how it's not for everyone, especially people who value a lot of privacy and independence. Although co-housing can seem like a utopia to some, critics point out that there's a downside in who's adopting the model and who can afford it. Research has shown around 95% of co-housing residents are white, and 66% have graduate degrees. But many co-housing advocates are working to improve diversity, and there is interest from a wide range of people in the idea. About 4 years after moving into co-housing, and after 17 years together, Ted and his husband decided to split. They eventually were able to work out both logistics and finances for both of them to stay in co-housing. Ted's ex kept the house, but Ted also stayed in the community. The kids go back and forth and spend 50% of their time with each parent. Ted was still presenting as a woman at the time of the split and says although feelings about his gender had been with him for a long time, it was not a central issue to his divorce. But after the split, Ted started to explore his gender identity in a new way.
So the trickiest thing was making the decision. I always knew that I had sort of what I would call gender issues going on. But to be honest, I thought that every woman had that. And I was so firm. I was such a strong believer in that story that it took many blows till that one fell, actually. I remember overhearing a conversation of women of how glad they are to be women. And that one really stuck with me of like, hold on, there are women who want to be women. That was completely news to me. I had no idea. I thought everybody just arranges themselves with the fact. You know, and then I always conflated sexism and my own gender preferences. So it took me a while to understand that those are separate issues. Yes, it's hard to be a woman and there's a lot of disadvantages that come with it, but that's not why I want to transition. I always thought that's why I wanted to transition. Like, cool, yeah, like everybody would want to be a man. That's a better deal, right? But I realized then that there are women who like being women despite all the disadvantages, and it wouldn't even occur to them that being a man would be something desirable. And that's when I started looking at it more. Because I had always told people my life would be much easier if I were a guy, because that would just make much more sense. I would actually be, that's hardly anything else to say, that would just make more sense with who I am. So then I did what we all do, right? I Googled it. Then what popped up was what they call the button test. And it's something like that. Like if there were a button that you can press and you are all of a sudden in the other in the other sex's body with no social repercussions, So you don't have to think about, you know, all the negative things that people can say or think. And it's irreversible. Would you press the button? And my reaction to that one was interesting. So I read this test, and what was rising in me was just pure anger. Of like, well, that is such an idiotic, stupid test, because everybody would push that button. And then I paused and I thought, hold on. What if not everybody would want to push that button? Oh, I think I just passed the test. Because to me, that was such a no-brainer that I would push it that I didn't even understand the question as such. So that's when I started looking at it for real. And then I was, you know, kicking and screaming quite a bit still, because it seemed too big of a label to take on. It was not that I was happy about it at all. It took me quite a while.
So what was your sort of first step in exploring that identity beyond just thinking that just considering that the label might fit you?
I read somebody's biography and I had this cool moment. So that was somebody who also transitioned female to male. I had this cool moment of reading the book, and from time to time I threw the book on the couch and like, oh, dang, another thought that I could have written. I thought it was just crazy me having those thoughts. Okay, so a whole book of all the crazy things that I would never dare to say out loud. Okay, they were all gathered in a book. That was mind-blowing to me. And then I took the book and I looked at it sort of from the bottom to see how far into the book I am. And it was about a third in. And the thought in my mind was, oh, that's where I am right now. The rest is like looking into the future. So then it was clear, okay, I'm going to transition. That's now what I'm going to do.
At this point in his story, he's transitioning from presenting as a woman to identifying as a man. He began exploring changing from his birth name to being called Ted and tried it out on a 3-week trip.
Being called my old name felt so absolutely wrong to me after those 3 weeks. It was really easy to get used to my new name. So it was clear, okay, I need to act now because I can't stay in this vague place anymore. And I wanted the kids to hear about it first. Luckily, they know one transgender person. And so the younger said, so like that other person, right, saying that kid's name. Like, yeah, exactly. Oh, okay. That kid was 4. At the time, 4 years old, so that was number 5. Then number 4's reaction was like, oh, okay, you decide who you want to be. Sort of, she's very strong in that narrative of you do you kind of thing, which I have a little hesitation about, but it served me in this case. And number 3 was having a hard time just because what she was saying was there were already so many changes in the family.
Right.
Now what's that going to do? So she was afraid. She was afraid of what people would say. So that was the trickiest. And the 2 older ones, they really, I would say, lived their own life quite a bit. So they didn't seem to depend on who I am for themselves. They were just happy for me. Yeah, so they each had their own response, but they all made sense to me. We then went on vacation soon after, and I asked them to stop calling me Mom. Hmm. Just because I could actually see myself going back to Mom at some point, but right now I just don't think they have the awareness of in which places that is a good idea. And I don't want to teach them sort of the awareness of where's safe and where's not safe. That's not a discussion I necessarily want to have quite yet, at least for the younger ones. So my request was, don't call me Mom, call me Ted, which has its own problems. But that was the next step on that. And they know that I'm on testosterone, obviously, and they are great advocates for me. So whenever somebody uses wrong pronouns, they are the first ones to correct. You know, something like Mom, Mother, and so on. That's tricky between us and the rest of the world. It's not tricky between me and my kids.
So it sounds like they were able to process the news quite well and very maturely, and you were able to really establish good communication with them. But, you know, the whole world is not always as accepting. Have they experienced any difficulties from their friends or peers, or has there been other things that have concerned them since this has happened?
Well, one of my kids does get teased on the bus, sadly. Something like, your family is messed up. So, yeah, that happens. And I do pass as male 100%. So it never happens that somebody doesn't know my pronouns or that I'm a man just by seeing me now. It's more people that knew me before. But so it's not, so if I am, let's say I take them to the library, there's never the question. It's just, you know, a dad and his kids for people. So,
right.
And that passing privilege really makes it very easy, and we're sort of in choice over who we tell what.
What have your interactions with other parents been like now that you present in a more masculine way?
That's a big topic. I'm very much aware of how I'm being perceived in public. I remember when I first changed my name on email and I first put my automatic vacation, like that automatic response that you're on vacation in, I was celebrating that I could write, you know, for the next 2 weeks, I'm going to be offline, I'm going to be spending time with my kids. And I know that coming from a guy, that sounds amazing and cool. Coming from a woman, not so much. So, you know, I'm exaggerating here, but there is a tendency in that. So I love being on the other side and just raking in that privilege. And, you know, I say it as if it's funny, and I'm aware that it's not really.
You know, so much of parenting and getting through what can be difficult about parenting and building bonds as parents, I think a lot of moms have that sort of seek out and have that sort of mom-to-mom relationship where you feel like you can have friends that you can talk to and trust and be honest with. Has that changed at all for you?
Yeah, definitely. And people that don't know me, where typically the mom-to-mom trust was there, that's just gone. Completely gone. And I'm still in shock about how gone it is and how that's something that we don't talk about in society. The suspicion with which men are treated quite a bit. Like, I'm going to give you an example. I was paying at a gas station without kids. Person in front of me, a woman, had a kid with her, and the kid was maybe, I don't know, 8 or 9. Kid was turned towards me and was just smiling or just looking at me. And, you know, if somebody in front of you smiles at you, you smile back, that you just acknowledge the existence, right? And her mom, saw her kid smile at somebody, looked over her shoulder, saw me, and then pulled her kid closer to her with her arm. And I thought that was really sad because, you know, it was the first time it was like, whoa, hold on, did you just think I'm dangerous? That's weird. I actually checked with some cis men, you know, like, is that your experience? Is that what people do? And said, oh, yeah, all the time. And that was just new information to me. I had no idea. Or just being on the playground, you know. It used to be that presenting female, you had all, like, you could just walk up to any other mom and talk. And now that's not an option because it's always a little suspicious of like, what does that guy want from us? Like, is he flirting? Is he dangerous? Where's his kid? I hope he's here with the kid. Like, you can really see them going through all those things. It's so uncomfortable. So and then typically the pattern that I observe is that often, even if there is a dad on the playground, that dad tends to be not as social. So it's very lonely on playgrounds these days. Mm-hmm. That's something that I did not see coming and that I'm really sad about.
Are there expectations or things that you feel freed from doing now that you don't identify as a mom?
It does make it a little easier to co-parent, although it was already fairly easy with my ex. I now sometimes have to sort of tell myself, no, I'm not going to pick up the slack now because I don't have that role anymore. You know, it's like, no, we're really equals and I just don't do it. I don't know. There's a lot of, you know, it's still fresh for me. So I spend a lot of time thinking about these things and wondering what is my contribution and what's really real out there in the world. I don't know. It's hard to tell all those apart.
What you were just saying, in co-parenting, you occasionally have these moments of thinking, oh, it's not my job to pick up the slack. Has that sense of sort of self-sacrifice, has that changed at all now that you are identifying as a parent and not as a woman parent?
You know, I'm really endlessly torn on that because I still have, you know, I still have that voice in me that would like to say now, well, but somebody does have to pick up the slack. Just taking the sacrifice out of parenting also doesn't seem to be a complete story because there is some sacrifice involved. And sometimes doing it with a sacrifice kind of attitude actually helps getting it done. So, I guess a fair summary is that I don't really have a good role model of how to parent without the sort of sacrifice mindset or in rebellion to it.
I wanted to go back to this question you've noticed when you talked about sort of proudly claiming you're out of office. I'm spending time with my kids. I'm going to claim my privilege in the workplace as someone who appears as a man. Have there been any other changes in how you feel like you're perceived in the workplace now that you're presenting more as a man?
Well, I've always been fairly assertive, and it's been held against me and all that. I actually read a study that it's, you know, assertiveness is held against women quite a bit. So I'm glad that I don't have to fight that one anymore. I've actually backed off more from that assertiveness. It's a little bit like being handed a very powerful weapon and being aware that maybe it's not even a good idea to use it, no matter how much you want it. That's how I perceive male privilege. It's like, okay, I'm aware I have it. I'm aware it's powerful. I'm aware I love it. And how about we don't, how about we tone it down a little?
How has your transition made you think differently about how mothers are perceived and treated in society?
That's such a big question. Again, I can really only best talk about myself and not so much about, you know, how mothers perceived in society. I don't know. I only see that with my tainted glasses, right? Because what's actually quite a curse is that I, as I said, have heightened awareness around gender dynamics. And I'm going to say something very unpopular, and that is that my awareness is also pretty, like, I'm very sensitive around the many situations in which women perpetuate gender roles quite a bit. For example, yesterday I was waiting at the orthodontist, waiting till my daughter was done, and there was this woman there that had to make a new appointment for her daughter, and she was the whole time complaining about her incompetent husband who, you know, took the daughter to the office but failed to make a new appointment, failed to get the new this and that, and failed to get this. And I was really uncomfortable hearing how she was talking about a grown-up person, you know, just sort of, and the people working at the orthodontist were all women. So I think she was playing on that, let's talk about incompetent, stupid husbands that don't even know how to parent. So what I'm saying is, I am aware of all of this, a lot of it more than before, and I don't like what I see on many sides. So, and I know that's not a popular opinion to point out that sexism has its contribution not only from the side of males. So that I consider a curse, that I can see that now. It's sort of all the many ways in which women sometimes play themselves down and so on. Of course, I also see the other side, you know, what males do. I want to mention that I'm aware of that. But that I saw before too. But now that I've sort of stepped one step away from the world of women, I look at it and that's a really tricky one. And I'm not super comfortable talking about it because I know it's such a hot issue.
You know, one question I have is looking back on your own experiences in, even though it sounds like you had conflicted feelings about your gender identity for many years, you know, went through many pregnancies and births and had some very sort of defining moments where you occupied a very gendered space, you know, as a pregnant woman and as a mother with a baby and all those sorts of things. Do you think back on some of those experiences and see them differently now?
No, and I'm guessing, you know, that is a question I get from time to time, and I'm guessing that I'm going to lose some credibility here. But to me, these are not super gendered experiences. I know that's hard to believe, and I'm not making any point except for just saying how it is for me. So I'm not making any bigger statement than that. It was not very gendered for me. There's also this little piece of me that thinks that maybe I love being pregnant because finally my body was good for something. I think that played a role of like, well, at least, you know, this is completely not what I want. But hey, if you can make little humans, that's pretty awesome. And breastfeeding is just endlessly convenient. And I like the connection. So for me, it's more connection with my kids. It's not really gendered. But, you know, I typically resist the summary of having seen things from both sides. That's so great because I don't think that's an accurate statement. In this case, that experience, I think, was great to have. Being able to access something that is really reserved for the other side.
Special thanks to The Double Shift for that introduction to Ted. That podcast just closed out its third season with co-host Angela Garbez. She joined Catherine for conversations about mothering in COVID times. And you can find all of those conversations at thedoubleshift.com. You can also hear more from Catherine Goldstein and Angela Garbez in the Embodied episode, Mothered. Remember, I would love to see you at Uneven Battlefield, a live taping of Embodied on December 17th at 7 p.m. We're talking about trans rights in the military and meeting some people who are influencing inclusion and equity in America's armed services. Register to join me under the events tab at wunc.org, and I hope to see you there. I'm Anita Rao on an exploration of our brains, our bodies, and taking on the taboo with you.